CJSF is looking for new volunteers to come in and make radio. No experience is necessary. You can learn to DJ, edit sound, produce news, make posters, and host your own show. Come out to a weekly station orientation to get involved. Orientation times can be found on our website at www.cjsf.ca.
States can never be certain about each other's intentions. And therefore, the best guarantee of survival is to be a hegemon, because no other state can seriously threaten such a mighty power. Since no state is likely to achieve global hegemony, the world is condemned to perpetual great power competition. We will go back to conflict, and there is no way that China is going to rise without U.S.-China conflict.
That's Jeffrey Sachs, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Jeffrey Sachs, Wars of Hegemonic Competition. Hegemony is from the Greek, meaning authority, rule, political supremacy. Since 1945, the United States has been the global hegemon. That is changing now. The U.S. recently issued its annual threat assessment. It makes for interesting reading. It lists the various threats Washington faces, and it repeats the embedded line that Russia's invasion of Ukraine was unprovoked. But the report's main focus is on China. It says, quote, China has the capability to directly attempt to alter the rules-based global order in every realm and across multiple regions as a near-peer competitor that is increasingly pushing to change global norms. Now, the phrase rules-based global order is vintage Orwell. Translated, it means that Washington rules the world and you'd better follow its diktats. But China is no pushover. It has emerged as the major challenge to U.S. hegemony. Thus, the danger of conflict is increasing. Our guest today is Jeffrey Sachs. He's an internationally renowned economist, author, and educator. He's director of the Center for Sustainable Development at Columbia University, where he is university professor, the highest academic rank. He served as special advisor to UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. He has twice been named among Time Magazine's 100 most influential world leaders. He gave the Allama Iqbal Lecture, sponsored by the Oxford Pakistan Program at Oxford University in the UK in early March. And now, Jeffrey Sachs.
I've been thinking a lot about the Ukraine war. I'd say morning, noon, and night. I'm very concerned and very upset because this is a war that is extraordinarily dangerous. It's a war that never should have happened. This is not simply a war that Putin decided unprovoked to launch in February 24th, 2022. That's nonsense for anyone who has been around. Just to tell you, I'm an old guy. I've been around. I was an advisor to President Mikhail Gorbachev. I was an advisor to President Boris Yeltsin. I was an advisor to President Leonid Kuchma, the first president of independent Ukraine, and to others. What you are being told about this conflict and others is not true. That's not a hunch. That's not an academic idea. That is direct knowledge firsthand for more than 30 years. And I want to explain these ideas. But most importantly, I want this to be a constructive session, problem solving. we're here to talk about international relations. Geopolitics is part of the field of international relations. International relations is a field of study of the interaction of states. There are many sound and good ideas in international relations theory, but I want to make a basic proposition that international relations theory is not just a description of the causes of war or the causes of war and peace, but the prescription of the way to peace as well. International relations theory should be inherently a normative field, not only a positive or descriptive field. It's not good enough to explain war. We don't have medical schools to explain disease. We have medical schools to cure disease. We don't have schools of public health to explain epidemics. We have schools of public health to prevent or to control epidemics. It's not for those disciplines merely prediction or merely explanation. If you are a cosmologist, it probably is a matter of explanation that you're after. But if you are in a discipline such as health or international relations or economics, I believe you are inherently in a moral field. Moral in the sense that you are inherently trying to improve the world. And the field of international relations should be a field to solve the problems of war. I want to hear from the universities how this war can end, not simply how to escalate more armaments. We're not hearing enough of that from the universities, frankly. And I want international relations theory to address the prescriptions for peace. And I'm going to give you a few. I believe that this is our business to try to design better solutions. One of the reasons for this is a very important statement by President John F. Kennedy. He said in his inaugural address, "The world is very different now. For man holds in his mortal hands the power to abolish all forms of human poverty and all forms of human life." That's January 20th, 1961. This is the modern reality. We have technologies that are remarkable, so remarkable that if we put our mind to it, poverty could be ended. Education could be accessible to every child in the world. We could have universal health coverage. We could ensure that basic economic needs are met by all. We could give young people the tools for productive lives. This is all within reach, and not just within reach in a idealistic sense, but in a very practical sense. But those same technologies, that same breakthrough in science of how semiconductors work or how solid state physics works, is also the same technology that enables us to make thermonuclear weapons, to destroy the world through nuclear war or through our reckless abandonment of the environment. It's something that Kennedy didn't think about. He was clearly referring to nuclear war. One thing to keep in mind in my talk is that Kennedy came in more sensitive to this subject than any president of modern history. Yet, he nearly stumbled into full-scale nuclear war in the Cuban Missile Crisis. And this is something telling for us also, because the world is difficult and complicated. And even if you come in with the wisdom of this statement, because of how state power works and misfunctions, and terrible blunders by Kennedy in the early stages of his government, especially the invasion of Cuba in the spring of 1961 and the lies that he told about it initially, by his actions and the subsequent actions of the Soviet chairman Nikita Khrushchev, brought us to not just the brink of nuclear war, but seconds of within the launch of nuclear war. And that's how dangerous our world is. That's what I want you to know. And therefore, when you're told don't worry, you're reading something from foolish people. Because if you're not worried, you don't get it. And we need to pull back from the brink through the things I'm going to talk about, rather than to push to the brink in this lackadaisical way that passes for the mainstream media. So one of the powerful books of international relations is written by one of America's leading scholars, and I have been together with him on this of trying to explain the Ukraine war through the provocations of the United States. John Mearsheimer is professor at University of Chicago, and he wrote a very powerful book in 2002 called The Tragedy of Great Power Politics. It talks about the tragedy of great power politics, meaning the wars that we fight. And while I admire John Mearsheimer enormously and we're friends, I want to go farther than this, because Mearsheimer says that the tragedy is inevitable of great power politics. And I don't believe we can accept tragedy as our fate, especially in the world that John F. Kennedy described. Tragedy in the past meant World War I or World War II. Tragedy in the future means the end of the world, because our technologies have brought the end of the world within reality, especially nuclear war. So we can't, in my opinion, accept an international relations, however descriptive, however predictive it is, we can't accept that as the end of international relations. We have to accept that as the start of international relations, because we need not the tragedy of great power politics, but the solution to the tragedy of great power politics. We need the great power peace. So what John Mearsheimer wrote is very powerful. And I just want to read it because it's really what is keeping me up at night and keeping me worried. He wrote, "The sad fact is that international politics has always been a ruthless and dangerous business, and it is likely to remain that way. Although the intensity of their competition waxes and wanes, great powers fear each other and always compete with each other for power. The overriding goal of each state is to maximize its share of world power, which means gaining power at the expense of other states. But great powers do not merely strive to be the strongest of all the great powers, although that is a welcome outcome. Their ultimate aim is to be the hegemon. That is the only great power in the system." And he says there are three features that lead to that: the absence of central authority, so international anarchy. In other words, there's no global Leviathan in Hobbesian terms. There's only anarchy at the top, and then states thrusting for power within that anarchic system. Second, the fact that states have offensive military capability. So you have to be aware that someone can launch the surprise attack or the first strike, and that that's a devastating fact. And third, that states can never be certain about each other's intentions. And therefore, the best guarantee of survival is to be a hegemon, because no other state can seriously threaten such a mighty power. Now, we can already reason isn't it a tragedy if everyone is trying to be number one? There's a little bit of a paradox there, that that means endless strife, an impossibility of different nations achieving that goal, and perhaps everybody ending up dead as a result of that struggle. But that is John Mearsheimer's point, that this is the tragedy of great power politics. And he says, since no state is likely to achieve global hegemony, the world is condemned to perpetual great power competition. That's realism in international relations theory. And there is nobody that has developed that theory more effectively and cogently than John Mearsheimer. And incidentally, this book was written in 2002 at a time when the U.S. had normal relations with China. It had normal relations with Russia. It seemed a calm world. The American exceptionalists felt very great about themselves, that it's the American world after all. And nobody much was talking about great power tragedy. And John Mearsheimer, to his descriptive and predictive credit, said, this will not go on. We will go back to conflict. And there is no way that China is going to rise without U.S.-China conflict. And he predicted all of this absolutely correctly. And that is the power of these ideas. But they are tragic. And so they are not quite powerful enough, because we have not yet had the power to surmount the tragedy. And that's what we need. So I want to talk about peace. And I want to talk about peace as the avoidance of war. And I want to talk about international relations and war as I see it. I would like to see the solutions come out of international relations as a normative theory of peace. So I believe we need to start with differentiating the kinds of wars that we are aiming to avoid, because they're not the same in all contexts, and therefore we're not talking about the same thing when we talk about peace in different contexts. I want to distinguish three categories of war. One are wars of the empire or wars of plunder. A second is the great power conflicts, that is the fights for who's number one. And the third is inter-ethnic conflict, conflict between groups. And I believe these are distinctive, and they require not only distinctive predictive theories, but also distinctive prescriptive normative approaches of how to stop these wars. So what are wars of plunder? Wars of imperial plunder certainly include the British conquest of the Indian subcontinent. They include the European conquest of Africa at the end of the 19th century. They include the United States' destruction of Native American nations, especially in the second half of the 19th century, a kind of series of genocides that aren't even counted as genocides, because when you're number one, you don't have to explain, and history somehow disappears. This was a period of destroying many nations in the United States. It was interesting to me, since I am generally sympathetic to China on most issues, and not fearing China, as I'm going to explain, somebody wrote to me, well, Mr. Sachs, you're so naive. Look at how China treats its various minorities. And I could only say, well, yes, the United States killed those minorities. One group we enslaved and then kept under apartheid for another century, the African Americans. So I think the Americans treated their minorities worse They're not even present anymore, except small numbers on Indian reservations. So it's all a matter of perspective. So these are wars of imperial plunder. Great power wars are wars of hegemonic competition. We could go back to the Peloponnesian Wars. We could even go back to, in a way, the wars of Persia and ancient Greece that Herodotus wrote about in the first history, the histories. But Athens and Sparta of the Peloponnesian Wars from 431 BC to 404 BC certainly qualifies as hegemonic wars, but within a smaller context. World War I was clearly a great power conflict, World War II. And then we should be clear that there are also proxy wars that are hegemonic wars. The Vietnam War was not a war really between the United States and Vietnam. It was a war between the United States and the communist world, especially the Soviet Union and China, in which Vietnam was the battleground. The Ukraine War is not a war between Russia and Ukraine, despite what you read every day. It is primarily a war between Russia and the United States, and it needs to be understood in those terms. And then there are inter-ethnic wars. Israel and Palestine is an example of that. Ethiopian war that is an inter-ethnic war. India-Pakistan wars are complicated, of course, but to a significant extent, they are inter-ethnic wars. These are quite distinctive. The wars are not hegemonic wars. The wars are clashes of cultures, clashes of societies, clashes of religion, actually. So basically, wars of plunder are wars of the strong versus the weak, and they are wars of injustice. Wars of great powers are wars of the strong versus the strong, and they're wars basically of competition. And wars of inter-ethnic conflict, I will say, are wars of the weak versus the weak, people who are fearful and fighting out of fear rather than out of a sense of wanting to dominate. They want to escape from fear. So as an economist, my observations are that economic change of various kinds lead to wars. And I wrote a book in 2020 called The Ages of Globalization, where I describe how technology and institutional change and physical geography interact to produce long-term global change across many different ages of globalization. But one of the notable facts of that study is that each new epoch driven by technological change was typically accompanied by war. And technological change in various ways leads to changes of relative power, and changes of relative power lead to wars of the kinds that I've described. So technological divergence, meaning that the more advanced technological countries gain some kind of decisive advantage over the others, lead to wars of plunder. Imperial wars are basically wars in which there is a more powerful adversary, usually based on more powerful economics and underlying military technologies that allow for an expansion of empire. Technological convergence means that the poorer countries are catching up with the richer countries. Surprisingly, that's also conducive to war, but typically to the wars of competition, because as the poorer countries are narrowing the gap with the richer countries, the two come into direct competition with each other. So periods of technological convergence tend to be periods of wars of competition. And I believe that's the dominant form of war that we have now, and why the great power conflicts are raging the way they are. Shared vulnerability of various kinds, even economic vulnerabilities, poverty and so forth lead to wars of fear and to interethnic violence. There is a absolute fact that at higher income levels, less hunger, longer life expectancy, inter-ethnic or intergroup struggles tend to diminish in fervor. There is the added fact of poverty and desperation over resources on top of the facts of the intergroup stress that are conducive to this third kind of war. So just as some quick example, the great engine of 19th century divergence was the steam engine. This is probably the most important invention of the last 1,000 years. In fact, in both economics and in geopolitics, it happened to be invented in Britain, in a workshop in the University of Glasgow by a very skilled and a very creative inventor, James Watt. And he was able to improve John Newcomen's 1712 steam engine and to patent a new steam engine in 1776. And boy, was that a good thing to do from the point of view of economic power, productivity, industrialization, inter-ocean transport, and military force. Britain became the first industrial society. It towered over the rest of the world in financial, military might, and that led to the so-called Second British Empire of the 19th century. So we see one of the great turns of history. These are the usual data that Angus Madison developed on global output. As late as 1820, Asia had 60% of world output. And as late as 1820, the Indian subcontinent was the manufacturing center of the world. It was still the textile center of the world. In 1790, the steam engine was connected to a belt to move the spinning jennies and to move the power looms, and the rest, one could say, history. Britain used every trick in the book, protectionism, control over the ports, military force, and mechanization to destroy the Indian textile industry in the early 19th century. And to subjugate India afterwards. In 1820, Asia had 60% of the world population, and then it went on a sharp downward course thereafter, and it reached its nadir in 1950 at 20% of the world population. So in 1820, per capita income in Asia and the rest of the world was roughly the same, not exactly, but roughly the same. And per capita income in Asia plummeted. Per capita income in the North Atlantic region, meaning Europe and North America, Canada and the United States, soared. And these lines cross. It happens around 1857. That's a coincidence because this is just a linear extrapolation. But 1857 is, of course, the notable date of the Sepoy Rebellion, the Indian Rebellion. And in 1858, the whole Indian subcontinent falls under what becomes the British Raj. And that change of power was a war of plunder made possible by this differential economic performance. Now, notice that the largest gap between the North Atlantic and Asia occurs in 1950, basically. And from then on, the lines start to converge again. This is extremely important to understand because it is in 1947 that India and Pakistan become independent countries. And 1949, the People's Republic of China becomes a new independent country after decades of invasion and civil war. And it is that independence which gives the base for a subsequent era of convergence. So broadly speaking, in economic